Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Tom Beal. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Susan, and to all your listeners. Today, we're going to talk about two issues that have generated a lot of controversy in our area. First, drones, both the hobbyist drones for taking pictures from small flying devices and the military drones, which are scheduled to replace the F-16s at the Air National Guard in Des Moines.
Then we'll have an update from a meeting of the recent Planning and Zoning Committee that rezoned the purchases from Breckenridge Economic Development Corporation. That's been a big controversy for a long time, for about a year, and it looks like they're making some progress.
Right. But first, we'll get started with the weather and our report on phenology from Pat Schlarbrum. Today, mostly sunny with a high near 37, wind chill values as low as 10, windy with a north-northwest wind 16 to 21 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 29 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 22, north-northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming light and variable. Thursday, sunny with a high near 56, southwest wind 8 to 11 miles per hour. Thursday night, mostly clear with a low around 35. Southwest wind, 8 to 11 miles per hour. Friday, sunny with a high near 52. Northwest wind, 9 to 15 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour.
What a nice weather report. It sounds like we'll be feeling some spring in the air by the end of the week. And it's appropriate for the three harbingers of spring Pat Schlarbaum will be telling us about.
Phenology is the recording of nature's happenings when they occur. The first woodland hepatica blooming in the spring, or the last osprey of autumn, are noted in a journal for future reference. Today's focus on phenology includes some of our migratory birds returning to Iowa, killdeer, red-winged blackbirds, and turkey vultures, kind of the big three of early migrants. First, the shoreburn community of birds has been represented by killdeer. Their name comes from their frequently heard call. These birds look to wetlands referred to as ephemerals this time of year. Ephemeral ponds contain shallow water in our landscape depressions that hold water during snowmelt and later with heavy rains. Shorebirds like killdeer appreciate the opportunity to wade and peck for invertebrates and seeds. However, as spring progresses and ephemeral ponds dry up, additional insects and larvae will appear to bolster their diet. Killdeer will inhabit open gravelly areas and are the least water dependent of the shorebird family. It's just that right now, open areas are still frozen and the ephemeral ponds provide a food-rich area. Often killdeer can be seen on roadsides and open parking lots, and these birds will frequently use a distraction display or broken wing act to distract predators and you from their nests. This involves the bird walking away from its nesting area, holding its wing in a position that simulates an injury, and then flapping around on the ground emitting a distress call. Predators that might be a feral cat or a raccoon at dusk think they have easy prey and are attracted to the seemingly injured bird and away from the nest. This is repeated until the predator is far from the nest and the killdeer suddenly heals itself and flies away. Their ability to exploit a wide range of agricultural and semi-urban habitat has helped keep them common and widespread in their Midwestern range. Once the killdeer appear, there will be a wide host of other shorebirds returning. We will be enjoying greater and lesser yellowlegs, dowitchers, sandpipers, plovers, soon to name a few. Here's the first welcoming call of the killdeer. Red-winged blackbird males have returned seeking to tack down territories for their mates in the coming weeks. These birds are common during summer, but very, very few over winter in Iowa. As harbingers of spring, their calls powerfully proclaim that spring is arriving. Red-winged blackbirds are common in swamps and marshes, but can be viewed in open pastures and agricultural waterways. Each pair raises two or three broods a season, building a new nest for each clutch. A pleasurable spring drive through our country roads with the windows down will solicit many territorial calls from the red-winged blackbirds. A third summer resident are early pioneers of turkey vultures. Turkey vultures are nature's janitorial service that primarily eat upon dead animals. They require unfrozen carcasses for nourishment. Consequently, they do not overwinter in Iowa. They are magnificent large dark birds and are sometimes confused with immature bald eagles. Turkey vultures' wing plane is dihedral or in the form of a V, which causes a tippy flight of wavering back and forth. In contrast, the wing profile of an eagle is planar and very flat. I once laid on my back and watched a turkey vulture soaring over southern Iowa that did not flap its wings for 22 minutes before it soared out of sight. I remember the day because there was a jet flying overhead, and I wondered if it contained the body of Dwight Eisenhower, who had recently passed away. I did not associate the turkey vulture with his death like in the movies. There will be a few turkey vulture individuals the next few days, then large flocks of 30 to 40 birds will be seen congregating at specific sites before dispersing across the landscape. One of these congregating sites is at Ledges State Park. Turkey vultures will be at our roadsides cleaning up roadkill animals the next few weeks. They will secure a nest site later in the spring in hollow logs or abandoned buildings. Their young of the year from last year will have a dark head, which will gradually become red as they mature into being adults. And that's our Focus on Phenology for today. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
Well, I understand that the Iowa State Senate is considering a bill to ban non-military drones. Do we have a report on that?
Yes, we have a hobbyist drone operator who sat in on a hearing at the Iowa State Senate recently and is pretty upset by what is being proposed. He's Scott Derringer, and we have him on the phone. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, thank you for being with us today. First, I think there are a lot of people who may not know what a drone hobbyist is. Can you tell us about that?
Basically, it's someone who was into radio-controlled aircraft, and they decided to put a camera on their aircraft or airplane, and then along came the quadcopters or the multi-rotor vehicles, which just sit and hover, and we got into those.
How big are these?
Oh, they come in all sizes, from ones that will fit in the palm of your hand that you can buy very cheaply. They come with little cameras already built onto them, up to big 20- and 30-pound monsters that carry a huge, expensive camera. Of course, those are more professional rigs used by the motion picture industry and, like, that's a football game. The one I'm using weighs about 2 pounds. Anybody that's interested to see what one looks like can just go to Google and punch in DJI, the initials DJI Phantom. They sell for around $500 up to about $1,200. They're really remarkable things. I can take this thing off and put it at 20 feet and just set the controller down, and then I could have it take a picture of me from the air, of me teeing off on the golf tee or something like that, or fishing or whatever. It's a great way to get a new perspective on a regular photograph or video.
Scott, that looks like a lot of fun, but do they have any, shall we say, practical purposes?
Well, you know, law enforcement wants to use them. Rescue people want to use them. The more expensive, larger ones could easily go look for a lost hiker in the woods, or go down the alley to look for the criminal who's hiding behind the dumpster with a gun before law enforcement approaches. I've heard of an instance where an amateur was actually called to a scene of a train wreck, and it was a derailment, and there was a car down the line that was spilled, and they didn't know what the substance was, and they sent his drone down there with a camera, and he was able to read the code on the side of the tanker to determine whether they were dealing with sulfuric acid or vegetable oil, and then that way they knew what kind of a hazmat team to send down there before endangered anybody. So, yeah, there's all kinds of practical purposes. The motion picture industry loves them because they're a lot cheaper to use than a helicopter. If you want that picture of the star holding a sword up on the cliff from the air, it's just so much easier than, you know, hiring a helicopter and a pilot and you know, 300 gallons of aviation fuel for, you know, 20 seconds of footage.
Then what are the objections to these?
Well, you know, when I sat in on the Senate subcommittee meeting, Senator Hogue, while he probably had someone's interests at heart, he didn't think it all through. He was worried about someone hovering over someone's backyard, taking a picture of their daughter sunbathing or something. All of these things which he was concerned about, I don't know of any cases that are out there pending. The thing sounds like a swarm of angry bees. There's no way it could hover over you without you not knowing it was there. Generally, the operator is within 100 feet of it. It's not like he could be totally out of sight across town. The thing mine only flies for 10 minutes tops. So, I mean, I got to be close. I got to see what it's doing.
Well, Scott, do you see any dangers outlined in this legislation? I'm sorry, Scott, I must have talked over you. I was asking if you see any dangers outlined in the legislation being proposed.
Yes, I do see dangers. I do think that the House bill, which came after the Senate subcommittee meeting and was probably influenced mostly concerned about legislating law enforcement activity, how long they can keep the video. They have to get a warrant before they put drone surveillance on somebody. But, yeah, there's some real dangers because the Senate subcommittee, the Senate bill, they wanted to outlaw cameras on any single model flying, even the hobbyists flying in the field. You know, we used to just put cameras on our planes, little key fobs cameras, to look at our tails and stuff and to see how our planes were, the control surfaces were working, you know, when we did specific things and see if everything was working fine, or if we did have an issue, we could see why it was that way. So there's a lot of reasons that.
So it looks like concerns over privacy is one of the major factors there in the legislation being proposed.
Yes, it seems to be, but you know, we live in a society where cameras are on you 24/7 at every intersection, in the Walmart, in the come and go, in a Quick Trip, at the casino, in a spy satellite, your house is on Google already. The NSA is listening to your phone calls. My little camera out there flying around down the river looking at the pretty fall foliage or be flying a glider with some bald eagles or some turkey vultures, which I've done, and trying to get footage of the birds in the air, this poses no threat to anybody. There's already laws against privacy invasion, trespassing. If you have a drone flying over your backyard, call the police. It's already illegal. You know, no one can come into your backyard with their drone. No one can, you know, spy on you. Your privacy cannot be invaded.
Could you shoot down a drone if you had a gun at your house?
Well, you know, you sure could. I mean, mine's not flying very high.
What if it's legal?
I'm very susceptible.
Well, you were raising some very interesting issues, and I think people now will be watching out for those hobbyist drones and maybe trying to contact hobbyist drone providers to get some footage for an event that they want to cover. Thank
we
you.
We would be happy to give an demonstration.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Scott, and have a nice day. And we're really pleased you could be with us.
Well, this is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, and events in Central Iowa. We've been talking with drone hobbyist Scott Derringer. Now we turn to more serious drones, the ones that are to replace the F-16s that have been part of the Iowa Air National Guard for 70 years. This was part of the recent military appropriations bill that made massive cuts to the military, and the loss of the F-16s was opposed by both Republicans and Democrats from our congressional delegation. But now that the bill has passed, the building for drones is already well underway. And from one military article I read, it is ahead of schedule. So why are we covering this issue?
Drone warfare is still not accepted in the United States. And this is something that also has bipartisan opposition, though mostly outside the government, as far as I know. One part of the opposition has scheduled an event this weekend, and that's what we'll be covering. We'll be talking with David Goodner from the Des Moines Catholic Worker House to tell us about the Midwest Catholic Worker and Veterans for Peace, Faith, and Resistance Retreat. Unfortunately, I couldn't find articles from the military sources online that seemed to me to be written for a civilian audience. We feel that we ought to have balance in our programming. Many of the newspaper articles that I found focused on the regret over losing the 21 F-16 jets from the Des Moines Area National Guard, and that is not the focus of the Veterans for Peace or the Catholic Worker. We couldn't reach anyone from the Air National Guard to explain the new policy, but from reading, I could see that part of this decision is financial. Here is a report from the Omaha World Herald. Would you read this report, please, Tom?
Well, under a budget deal set for approval this week, the Iowa National Guard's 132nd Fighter Wing will lose the jets. The decision comes after months of wrangling between Iowa's congressional delegation and the Air Force. The 132nd has flown F-16s on missions in Afghanistan in recent years. Now, after 70 years of flying manned aircraft, the wing will fly remote-controlled unmanned planes, according to the proposal. The aircraft will be based elsewhere, possibly overseas. U.S. House and Senate negotiators agreed to a deal this week that will mean the removal of all 21 jets from the Des Moines Air National Guard base. The House could approve the defense spending bill as soon as today and the Senate on Friday. President Barack Obama has signed the bill, incidentally. Iowa Guard spokesman Colonel Greg Hapwood said he could not yet comment in depth on the proposed change, but said it was driven by economics. Quote, "You have to figure out where we can do more with less, and these are the decisions the Air Force has made," he said. But unmanned aerial vehicles or drones are the wave of the future, said John Pike, director of globalsecurity.org, a military information website. The biggest reason is that they are less expensive to operate than fighter aircraft. The circumstances where you would use tactical aviation has diminished over the past decade, he said. Drones can also linger over the battlefield longer, and the pilot fatigue is not a factor, he said. And if one is shot down, no crew members are killed.
Now I'd like to introduce Dave Goodner from the Catholic Worker House in Des Moines. Hello, David.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
Well, we're pleased you can be with us. Before we start talking about drones, I think our listeners would like to hear just what the Catholic Worker House is.
So we basically run a soup kitchen and drop-in hospitality house for homeless or low-income disadvantaged people on the near north side of Des Moines in the Riverbend neighborhood just north of downtown.
And how long have you been there?
We've been there since 1976. Now, the Catholic Worker Movement nationally, more broadly, was founded in 1933 in New York City by Dorothy Day.
And what are the principles behind it?
Basically, we want to live in accordance to the justice and charity of Jesus Christ. We take a social justice approach to the Gospels and, feel like it's our mission to follow in Christ's footsteps by housing the homeless, feeding the poor, healing the sick, speaking truth to power, challenging the dominant political system with nonviolent direct action.
So you oppose drones. Now, I know that you have been opposing big military budget for a long, long time, and with these massive cuts, why don't you think this is a good place to cut?
Well, drone warfare is quickly becoming the 21st century model of military occupation. President Obama doesn't want the heavy footprint that boots-on-the-ground American troops have, like what we saw in Iraq after President Bush invaded Iraq. But drone warfare is really just sort of a imperial light policy that continues through the U.S. government, continues to murder and oppress people of color overseas, particularly in the Middle East, in order for the U.S. to dominate trade routes, access to oil to the world markets, and in general keep the capitalist global system up and running. And drones are responsible for war crimes, human rights violations. They've murdered innocent children, hundreds of them in Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan. We just had two community members return from 2 months in the occupied Palestinian territories. They saw drones flying overhead every day. It's a real problem, and now it's centered here in Iowa.
Well, if we're going to reduce our armed forces, what alternatives do we have to this technology?
Well, I think that's sort of a more existential debate about, you know, do you believe that the United States has military bases in every country in the world, 120 military bases around the world, and that we consistently project our power through the use of violence in order to defend ourselves? Or are we actually an imperial project dedicated to empire building in a way that reinforces our interests and the interests of the ruling elite that run this country and that run this country's economy? If you take the second view like I do, then you see that there is no justification for a world superpower to be committing these types of human rights violations using drones across the world. And in essence, we need to dramatically reduce our military budget. We can use the savings to reinvest in social services here at home.
I noticed that your workshop is sponsored by Veterans for Peace. I don't imagine Veterans for Peace usually works with Catholic Worker, or do they? Have they in the past?
Well, I think it's kind of a burgeoning relationship. I mean, Veterans for Peace have long been an integral part of the anti-war movement, directly impacted veterans into the anti-war movement, into the peace movement. They were around before the Vietnam War because they helped found Vietnam Veterans for Peace, Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So there is a local chapter here in Des Moines. Most of their members actually live at one of our Des Moines Catholic Worker houses. We own four houses in River Bend, and one of those houses is exclusively used to house veterans who are in the peace movement. So the cool thing about this weekend, I think, is that the Midwest Catholic Workers are coming from all over the Midwest, from Kansas City, Minnesota, St. Louis, Wisconsin, Chicago, all over the Midwest. We also have some Catholic Workers coming from places like Ithaca, New York, where there's a drone base that has received heavy resistance by a peace movement grounded there locally. Also from Las Vegas, Creech Air Force Base is right outside of Las Vegas and was one of the first sites in the country where anti-drone protests started happening a few years ago. There's Catholic Workers coming from both coasts to join us as well. On top of it, because of our relationship with the local Veterans for Peace chapter, as well as the Veterans for Peace chapter in Iowa City, they're putting together a pretty heavy turnout as well from their chapters around the Midwest. So we're looking at a few hundred people just coming from outside the region. That doesn't even count everyday Iowans in central Iowa that may also join our rally and vigil on Saturday.
Scott, maybe we can summarize what's coming up this weekend. The 2014 Midwest Catholic Worker Faith and Resistance Retreat will be held at Trinity United Methodist Church, 1548 8th Street in Des Moines. That would be March 14th through the 17th. And this year's gathering in Des Moines is being co-sponsored by the Veterans for Peace Des Moines chapter. The focus is drone warfare and the announced new DM Drone Command Center.
Is that correct?
Yep, you guys got it. And the rally on Saturday will start at 10 a.m. at the Iowa Air National Guard Base, 3100 McKinley Avenue. It's basically the north side of the Des Moines airport. That's going to be a mass demonstration. You know, we've done demos there before. Everything's going to be, you know, legal and by the books. We've got a lot of high-profile, at least by peace movement standards, what I would consider to be high-profile movement leaders. Three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee and Voices for Creative Nonviolence co-coordinator Kathy Kelly. She used to run blockades of medical supplies through the U.S. embargo into Iraq in the 1990s. In violation of federal law, very, very courageous acts that helped keep people alive. Former Veterans for Peace President Elliot Adams, very dynamic speaker, has been around a long time. We also have an Afghanistan war vet and drone expert Daniel Hale, as well as a number of Catholic workers from around the country, including the East and West Coast, who have been doing anti-drone organizing for years, some of the first people to really get going what's now kind of a mainstream issue.
I have to ask a question. Because a lot of the things you're talking about must sound extremely radical to some of our listeners, and they can't quite understand what's your relationship to the Catholic Church and even what's your relationship to homeless shelters. I imagine there are a lot of homeless veterans in your shelters that would be there if there wasn't any connection to Veterans for Peace. Is that right?
You know, half of the homeless men in this country are veterans, and we have a lot of homeless men that come into our house and live in the camps and can take a hot shower or get a hot cup of coffee to drink or get a hot meal to eat. They're probably using our services whether they agree with our politics or not, just because it's a social service we provide and they need it, and we don't ask any questions. You know, our house is open to anybody who wants to come in. But the Veterans for Peace specifically are veterans who have some kind of a shared political worldview and obviously organized together to around that worldview, and they have a lot in common with us and with our politics. And so it's kind of a new coalition, kind of a burgeoning relationship, like I said, but one that's, I think, been beneficial to both sides and helped make a stronger anti-war movement.
David, are you finding any support among members of Congress or even the state legislature in this effort to ban drones?
Actually, the front page story of the Des Moines Register today has a big story about the effort to regulate drones in Iowa by the Iowa legislature. The Iowa House passed a fairly restrictive bill last week or 2 weeks ago, and the Iowa Senate is taking it up in a Judiciary Committee meeting, I believe this morning, actually. I don't know a whole lot of details about the state bills because they are in some ways essentially going to provide a legal framework for drone operation in the state of Iowa that will legalize it to some degree. I'm not super in tune with the debate here and there. I'm more focused on kind of the outside pressure, sort of the street pressure. It's certainly an issue that I think is really, I mean, it's a national issue. I mean, people are talking about it at the state house. People are talking about it in Congress. I think the tendency of our political leaders is to expand the use of drones for surveillance and for war.
David, if you could summarize briefly what your goal is, what would it be?
Well, ultimately, we want to abolish all warfare and beat swords into plowshares and, you know, create a more just and democratic world that doesn't require the use of violence to maintain order. So that's the long-term goal. In the short term, you know, what we want to get out of this weekend, I think we want to send a strong message that drones are part of a system of oppression that the United States and the United States military has used, particularly in the Middle East, but really all over the world for decades. We need pacifist solutions to war, not more violence, and we need to start talking about the underlying economic inequality and the power relations that cause these kinds of things to happen in the first place. And that's sort of a discussion I think we'd like to have, and we hope that our work can make those conversations more possible.
Well, thank you very much for being with us this morning, David, and have a good retreat.
Yeah, we sure appreciate it. Thanks so much for all your work.
And I just want to mention, hearing these two side by side, David must be talking about the same
bill
that Scott was talking about.
Right.
It certainly sounds a lot different, doesn't it?
Right, it does, from a different perspective, but both of equal interest and concern.
Yes. After a little music break, we will join Sharon Goober to tell us some local news. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts today are Tom Beal and Susan Franzen, and we've been talking about drones from hobby to military and some responses to them among Central Iowans. Now we turn to an issue of pretty heated interest from the Planning and Zoning Commission. We have Sharon Guber here to tell us about it.
Hi, Susan. Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much. I am here as a representative of the College Creek Old Ames Middle School Neighborhood Association. I lived on State Avenue for 20 years, and my heart is there. More than a year ago, I got a call from neighbors over there saying that the Old Ames Middle School property was being considered to be sold. They had been at a meeting with the developer, Breckenridge Group, LLP, from Austin, Texas, that they were very, very interested and had showed them proposals for an all-student housing to be put on the middle school property. So we've been involved with that since September of 2012.
What objections do you have to all-student housing and why?
Well, the neighborhood is a heterogeneous neighborhood of young families, people who have lived there for 40 years, their children have grown up there, student renters who enjoyed the neighborhood now have bought homes, are raising their families there. We have a number of students. We have 56% rentals there, 44% owner-occupied. It varies from time to time. Living with students is enriching. We enjoy the students in the neighborhood. We would not want to see it, especially, you know, being close to campus, we would not want to see it absent of students. The concern is when you put all of any one kind in an area, you get a different kind of flavor to the neighborhood. Actually, what Breckenridge is looking for is a neighbor within the neighborhood, and they promote their housing online at repeated locations online and in their home website as a place for you to come live in your own neighborhood, students, with students, only students in your neighborhood. And it says, avoid living in a neighborhood of various ages of people who are unfriendly to students. That was an awful thing for to set that kind of a tone when what we're trying to do is have a blended neighborhood. One of the land use policy vision goals that is significant here is that Ames seeks a development process that achieves greater compatibility among new and existing neighborhoods. And so that's what we're liking. What we have is a situation where the school board has sold the property knowingly to an all-student rental housing project. They will get no money coming in to support the schools. So we were very concerned about that. We know that in 2012 that the city council and the school board association, or the school board rather, got together and they talked over what was an agreement in 2007 about how that land was going to be used. And we had been told since then, the old middle school, you know, the new middle school was established, old middle school was going to be gone, and that area would become a family neighborhood with the encouragement of bringing students, families with students into the neighborhood. Ames needs to have those funds. That's the only way that they get funds for programs, for staff, for teachers. When they sell a building, that money only goes into building structure. So what they got was money for building structure and not anything for the school program. That was a concern. So, you know, we went to the school board. Iowa State was concerned because they have property around there. They have the research plots. And one of the parcels, there are three different parcels. One of them is right next to the research plots. Valuable, irreplaceable investment there should there be any damage. The cross-country is now a nationally recognized cross-country facility. The concern about being right across the street from it, and then the traffic on the way, which would find shortcuts, including maybe the Arboretum and so on. So Iowa State, neighborhood, others had expressed concern about the sale. And so now, since the sale has happened, We've been going through the process. We met for 2 months with Breckinridge and Iowa State representatives and city representatives to talk about issues. They made several proposals. The city said, you need to have a master plan. And in October, they presented with their application master plans that were accepted as being viable. And so then the process went on. Until that point, it could not proceed into the process of planning and zoning, public hearings, and then ultimately council hearings with a council decision on zoning. So what we're looking at is the zoning process.
Well, in what sense were these viable? Clearly, they don't meet the criteria you're talking about.
Well, in the code, there are specific things that have to be in a master plan. And there are four criteria for whether the council would require a master plan or could require a master plan. And these properties met all four. I mean, if the floodplain wetlands being developed in phases, things like that. So the council, in addition to that, wanted more information. And they had A through F, and I didn't bring those to name them. And then the university, through Warren Madden, had sent a letter that had about 15 concerns that they had. And those were put into a motion, and the council voted unanimously, 6-0, to have those part of the master plan. Also, they wanted even though the Breckinridge had put forth only two applications for rezoning, for the middle parcel and the south parcel, none for the north parcel, the city council said, we want to see all three parcels in the master plan. And we talked that way for 2 months. We received proposals from them that had the three parcels. They really didn't address specifically concerns that we had, like flooding. The numbers are very important in terms of how that develops. And the city also wanted to make sure that if this should not succeed, that it would be repurposable. In other words, that it wouldn't be, as it started out, a single parcel of land with a lot of buildings on it. Then somebody has to buy the whole thing with those buildings. The city had already had a problem in a development on the north side that was privately developed. The developer went bankrupt. The streets were not up to code because they were private streets, and they were starting to fall apart, and the citizens wanted the city to come in and fix the streets, and the city can't because they're private. So they didn't want that to be happening should this later on not continue as student housing. So with those things listed, we discussed it, and then they made their final master plan that went in with their application for rezoning, and it showed nothing. It doesn't have any buildings on it. It showed a street going down through extending trip to State. It doesn't have anything that was just the middle parcel with the middle parcel. It was just the south parcel with the south parcel. Nothing for the north parcel. They went to the code minimum requirements.
Sharon, I wonder if it would be helpful, some listeners may have just tuned in, just to kind of bring them up to speed on what we're talking about here. This is the development being proposed in the area near the old Ames Middle School. And the question really is, should it be a program or a development exclusively for student tenants, student residents, or should it be a mixed neighborhood that would include permanent residents and some rentals too, I presume?
Well, that certainly was the issue prior to the sale, and there was someone, a local contractor, who had another idea of how it would be developed. After the sale, that's no longer an issue because the purchaser, Breckinridge in this case, or any developer, has the right to develop it as they wish.
As long as they can get it zoned appropriately.
Zoned appropriately, but then with any zoning, it could be private or it could be rental. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no...
Could I ask you, I understand that you met with the school board on Monday. Could I ask you what you hope to have them do?
Yes. Well, by code... properties that are within 200 feet of the parcel under consideration, in this case it's the south parcel. The south parcel has their west border is the east border of the middle school. So it's very much, obviously, within 200 feet. Parties within, people who own property within 200 feet have the ability to file a protest. And by doing that, if the amount of the properties, not the number of people, but the amount of the property is equal to 20% or more of that property out within the 200-foot border, then that kicks in a requirement for the council to have 5 votes in order to pass a zoning instead of the 4 votes. And so we were at that time asking if the school board saw the concern that we saw, which was this developer had shown us they have always wanted on that parcel to have medium density. Well, they always wanted to have medium density on all the parcels, but the middle parcel turned out to be different, and I could talk about that later. Focus right now is on the south parcel. The south parcel has a range. What they did have to do in the master plan is put a range of the number of units that they would have. And they put a range of 193 to 432 housing units on that one parcel, which could take the number of residents, because it's medium density, up over 2,000 on that one parcel. And so we said, you know, are you aware of, do you have a concern? Because what that's going to do is put a student housing unit right next to it, the ones, of course, on Mortensen south of it, and then the ones over on the west side and the ones that are on the north side, and this would put the middle school right in the middle of that kind of visiting traffic. That happens Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. So we wanted to know, would you know, maybe you don't want to go speak in front of the school board, in front of the council. They haven't done any of that. But you could sign this, petition. They opted to wait and see what, well, at least one of them, Mike Espeset, said, let's wait. The others, including the superintendent, were falling back to the pre-sales position that they had, is zoning is not our issue, you know, that's the city's issue. But this had to do with being supportive of the middle school, you know, being supportive and protective of the middle school students, of their property. And, you know, you can have very much fewer. If you have RL zoning for that, the maximum that you would have would be 315 compared to 2,000 student residents there. So that's what we were asking them to do. After that meeting, the meeting, board meeting before this one, on the 3rd of March, they said, or Mike said, let's see what planning zoning does, and then we'll go from there. And maybe the neighborhood would have their required, well, we only have 25% of the property for, you know, that it's not Iowa State, not the school district, and even Breckenridge has property that they have within 200 feet, so are considered a neighbor to themselves. Since that time, we have gone over the 20%. It's being checked now to make sure that that is true. But it goes beyond just that, and that's what we spoke to on this Monday. And we've been sending email information, attachments, and so on, you know, so they would have an idea, have pictures of maps and traffic patterns, and so there's background information besides what we spoke to. But the point we were making is that maybe the communication was missed. What we're saying is the school board concerned about this great number, excessive number, of student residents next door, and do they foresee problems of damage to property? I mean, not only is it getting to a party, it's also what happens on the way to and on the way back.
So what would you say the school board's reaction was? Are they sympathetic to your concerns?
Well, of course, you can only speak to them in public forum, and they give no reaction. But reading yesterday's paper, both the superintendent, basically was speaking for them and said, you know, this is something we'll let the city determine what's going to happen with that property. The thing is that all of us, as property owners, as neighbors, as people interested in Ames, have input. And what we said was this input from the board could be significant. They may speak as individuals. I don't know if any of them will.
Well, I think that from the perspective of a
the listening audience. You started out by talking about what the neighborhood looked like, how it was mixed-use, older homes, and unfortunately, you can't reproduce that. You know, a lot of those student rentals are because they're older homes and students can afford to live in them. So that can't be reproduced. What would you like to see in this space?
What we'd like to see is RL zoning, subdivision compliant. And with the south parcel, you have College Creek that goes through there. It's pristine. When you go to look at other apartment complexes around there, where people don't have actual property ownership, there's litter, there's... And this doesn't have it. The students from the middle school used to come all the way down, because this was all school property, and they would come down to the homes, the creek that's behind the homes there on Morningside, and one of the owners is a former professor at Iowa State and then high school science teacher, Mike Peterson, and, you know, casually run into them, and the instructor knew him and would ask him, you know, to talk about the area. So it was a no-cost field trip experience. We would like to also see that become a conservation easement, protecting the habitat, the wildlife. There are, I forgot how many near extinct species. He's been keeping track of this for 40-some years.
Well, you mentioned something about a zoning, a particular kind of zoning, which mm-hmm. I would guess most of our listeners don't know what that means. But in simple terms, you're preference is that this area be zoned for houses, not for apartments. Is that
and it
correct?
Will be. It will be zoned for houses, except on the middle parcel. I should say RL is low density. It's one house on one lot. The lot minimum size is 6,000 square feet. And so it would be. And subdivision compliant means that it would have the amenities that are required by subdivision. So, yes, it will be housing. The south parcel, because it's floating suburban, and Breckenridge is asking for medium density, RM. So you'll see FSRM is the designation for zoning for them. They could have apartments on there. They don't build apartments. They build what looks like a home attached. They could go attached up to 12 by code, and that maximizes the number of people who could live in a given area, because an individual in RL would be 6,000 square feet per each lot, and with the FSRM, it would be like 3,500 for the first unit and 3,500 for the other end unit and 1,800 for the ones in between. So you can see you can get many more units on there. We're also concerned about the impervious surface that's going to be created, because the slope over there is over 18%. The runoff, when you have impervious parking and building surface, is going to do damaged or increase the flooding potential.
We have touched on an issue that we'll have to do another show on, and that has to do with how do we accommodate the growing population in Ames when the property that is available for housing is being restricted as to how many people can live there. And so the question is, where do people live if they're going to be in Ames? And we're seeing growth not only at the university but at the at our industrial park as well. So as we have more jobs coming to Ames, I mean, I've already heard many people saying it's too expensive to live in Ames now for the everyday person. Where do these people live? So at some point, not this particular hour because we're out of time pretty quick, we're going to have to explore that issue.
I'd appreciate doing that. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for being with us, Sharon, and at least getting us started on this issue that I can see is really very important to the future of Ames, although not well known.
Can I make one announcement that on March 25th, we do have word now that the city will be taking the south parcel to City Council, and the City Council might make a final determination on the 25th. So we would encourage people to be informed and also to be at the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon.
Well, you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Our guests today have been Scott Derringer, David Goodner, Sharon Gruber, and our Local Talk program is engineered
by Rebecca Brown.
And we want to thank Rebecca for being such a good sport, getting here at the crack of dawn when our show is first aired. Our theme is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive for all of the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012 on our website. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you'll find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
Well, if you've enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budget. We'd also like to hear your feedback either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.